Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is sponsored by Verizon Media. Verizon Media builds connections that grow businesses. They connect audiences to the things they love, connect brands to those passionate consumers, connect advertisers, publishers, and broadcasters with easy-to-use solutions that are trusted to perform. That's truly connected. Learn more at verizon.media/VMAUDIO21. Hey everyone, welcome back. My name's Zach. I'm delighted to welcome Tim Huang to the podcast. Tim is a writer, lawyer, tech policy researcher. His book, Subprime Attention Crisis, that came out last year, makes the case that online advertising is a bubble set to burst. What makes the book, in my opinion, worth reading is that Tim reaches beyond the usual tropes used by privacy advocates, mostly avoiding overblown terms like surveillance capitalism, which, although he does indulge just a little bit of that, but that's fine. Rather, he carefully describes how the intricacies of ad tech and the warped incentives of both ad agencies and ad tech platforms to maintain a steady flow of ad dollars have created a persistent opacity in programmatic markets that actually amounts to vulnerability. He argues that this opacity kind of obscures the fact that targeted ads do not work nearly as well as marketers think they do. And in fact, they're working less well all the time. Therefore, he says, only a matter of time before the bubble bursts and advertisers pick up their toys and go home, slashing their huge investments in programmatic, possibly leading to a near collapse, partial collapse of the free internet. So huge ideas that he's grappling with. Obviously, I think a lot of our listeners probably already have their hackles up. So I'm looking forward to chatting with him here over the next 30 minutes. Tim, welcome.
Zach, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, great to have you. So as I said there at the top, you know, what impresses me about this book is you clearly have a very deep understanding of ad tech, how it works, not just the idea of programmatic pipes, but how each of the constituents in this industry, the role they play, how they operate, sell-side platforms, buy-side platforms, and the other intermediaries. So I'm curious, that was a big research project. What made you want to write this book? What made you embark on such a large undertaking?
Sure, absolutely. So the origins of this book actually come from my time working at Google. For a period of time, I served as a global head of public policy for AI and machine learning at the company. And you know, I think one of the most interesting things about Google is, you know, on the day-to-day basis, right, people are not really talking about how the company makes money, right? People are talking about self-driving cars and artificial intelligence and all the kind of crazy experimental projects that the company is working on. And very rarely, in some ways, does the topic of, you know, programmatic ads come up in the conversation. And I always thought that was such a kind of odd omission in a lot of ways. And it wasn't really just the fact that I was kind of in public policy land, right? Like you would talk to engineers at the company and you would say things like, you know, indulge me for a second, just explain how this all works, right? And they would say, oh, well, you know, Google, we run on ads, right? Ads are where our money comes from. But even among kind of technical people at the company, there was a very extremely sort of, I would say, limited understanding of the business model of the company. And I just got so intrigued by that, right? Because most companies, they talk about how they make money all the time. But here, you know, it just kind of wasn't in the culture at all. And, you know, I sort of got digging and sort of the more and more I dug, the more interesting it became because, you know, and I don't need to tell your listeners this, right? The programmatic ecosystem is this kind of incredibly intricate piece of machinery that's just operating at scale every single day of the year and is largely invisible. And so the project of kind of understanding that and trying to explain it to a much broader audience was something I got really excited about.
Okay, great. Well, I'd like to start with sort of the metaphor at the heart of your book. You decided to sort of contextualize the contemporary targeted advertising ecosystem by comparing it to the subprime mortgage crisis that happened in 2007, 2008. Why did you decide on this particular analogy for the programmatic space?
Yeah, you know, it's actually funny, and I've made this joke elsewhere, but having written the book, it like only really struck me in the face was you know, usually you use a metaphor to try to simplify a situation in some ways. And I think it is funny that like for the programmatic ad ecosystem, I was like, what's the simplest metaphor we could use? Well, one of the most complex financial crises of, you know, the 21st century. But you know, I really kind of landed on this metaphor for two major reasons. You know, the first one is that a common argument that I got when I was researching the book, you know, talking to friends who, you know, run ad systems at places like Facebook, right, was your argument is wrong because it's impossible for, you know, $80 billion plus dollars to be wrong. And, you know, I think that, you know, in some ways that is a kind of fallacy. It's very easy to believe that like, okay, how could it be possible that so much money and so many people could just be getting this wrong? But, you know, I think that becomes less of a foreign idea once you start thinking about financial crises like the subprime mortgage crisis, right, where you had, you know, a global market that was considered rock solid and growing at incredible speed, and in many ways kind of dwarfed, right, the programmatic ad ecosystem in sort of economic importance. And as yet, right, there was a kind of time bomb at the heart of it, right, that really, you know, kind of rolled back a lot of the gains that people thought existed in those marketplaces. So I think one reason to use the metaphor is that I think it calls our attention to the idea that, yeah, sometimes $80 billion can be wrong, right? And that a whole market can really get it wrong in a way.
It's possible to have a massive blind spot.
Totally. Yeah. And in ways that no one's really paying attention to, and it seems completely implausible, right? So I think that's the first reason. I think the second one is really that the metaphor points to sort of the complexity of the ecosystem and the kind of perverse incentives that are often in the ecosystem, right? Because I think one of the things that we learned from the 2008 crisis isn't necessarily that they were, you know, a small group of people in a smoke-filled room being like, we're going to run this scam on the whole country. What it really was a structural issue of lots of people's incentives being pointed in the wrong direction. And obviously some actors were more responsible than others, but ultimately this was kind of a systemic problem, right? And I do think that the metaphor is also useful in that it kind of points us towards thinking about, okay, you know, this might not be some kind of mass conspiracy, but maybe we need to really think about like what kind of incentives these markets are setting up and whether or not those incentives are sustainable over time. So those are the main reasons why I thought the metaphor was apt, even though it kind of pointed towards a thing that was also notoriously complex and difficult to understand.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Now, I mean, another aspect of this metaphor, I think importantly, is that the product being purchased during the mortgage crisis was just like poor quality home mortgages that were likely to default. And mm-hmm. you draw a direct line there to the poor quality of attention in the programmatic ecosystem. You characterize that as being a matter of banner blindness, as a matter of brand safety issues and fraud issues that have plagued online. I think all of that is something most of our listeners will be aware of. And in fact, a lot of advertisers are aware of these issues. Mm-hmm. But you say the issues are bad and getting worse, and they're concealed by kind of the opaque nature of platforms. You can think you're buying, you know, a pork belly, a subprime mortgage, a unit sure. of online attention.
Yep.
But in fact, you're not getting what you think you're getting. So I think that's interesting. I do have a little bit of a beef with the argument that
sure, let's bring it. Yeah, it was funny. I was on a debate with Randall Rothenberg last week, and it like, man, really got the blood pumping. So I mean, I would love to debate this, because I mean, again, I think part of it is to have the discussion, right? Because I do think reasonable minds can differ on a lot of these issues. And sure. So yeah, let's get into it. I mean, we'd love to talk about exactly that. So.
Okay, good. Yeah, happy to. Okay, great. And then just to finalize the arguments, I just want to make sure the audience understands all the arguments. So programmatic is on shaky ground because that quality of attention is poor. And then as a result, online ad inventory is steadily decreasing in value over time, even as prices go up. And then finally, you know, ad targeting doesn't really work as advertised. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about that. The interesting work being done by Nico Newman and others around sort of trying to mm-hmm. prove that this, you know, ad effectiveness is actually more a matter of correlation, not causation, at least in the programmatic space. Programmatic pipes are succeeding in identifying people who will convert, serving them ads, and then making itself appear to be effective, when in fact it's not the case, you argue. So those are kind of the arguments out there.
Yeah. And right. And I think to that, I would only add a final argument that, I don't know, might piss off some of your listeners. But I do think that one of the arguments also is that there are kind of, again, perverse incentives to oversell, right? That actually, like, regardless of what the metrics are, the industry has kind of really driven home this dream of data-driven advertising in a way that makes it very difficult to admit where the ecosystem is failing. And I do think that that also helps to inflate the bubble, right? Even as kind of the underlying value deteriorates. So that's probably the only other thing I'd add.
Okay, great. So I guess, you know, I don't necessarily want to debate you point by point. You might talk circles around me if you did that, but I do want to speak to a couple of things in your book. One is this idea that transparency does not exist in this market. Where, you know, as a journalist who's written about it for many years, I mean, I've covered the fraud issue, and I was in fact the guy who originally broke a story that ended up being really damaging to AppNexus, which is one of the exchange platforms in our space, because you know, I was able to determine that a very, very large percentage of the available ad inventory on the AppNexus exchange was non-human traffic. And it's something that certainly they were aware of, and a lot of the intermediaries in the space were aware of and angry about it, because they didn't want to, like, pass this on to their clients. You know, agencies didn't want to be buying non-human traffic. So I think there was an issue that I think the transparency has existed from time to time. And certainly there's a cat and mouse game here. Just as soon as a journalist uncovers one issue of a huge bot, you know, fraudulent network, another one crops up elsewhere. So I'm not saying that transparency doesn't exist. I mean, sorry, has solved, you know, has exposed all of the problems, similar to what you describe in the book. But it feels to me like the transparency has emerged. What do you think?
Well, yeah, and I guess maybe there we sort of agree to disagree in some ways. I mean, I think there's kind of two arguments I'd bring up. One of them is the one that you're already pointing to, which is, look, journalists fighting the good fight, right? Like, we would not know a lot about the problems of the market if journalists like you weren't out there unveiling, you know, and like digging this stuff up, right? But I think, you know, the kind of challenge with that is, how much are journalists not seeing, right? And how much of this are journalists winning the day on a particular situation, but overall the market is still kind of very difficult to see into, right? And so I do think that, like, journalists are doing good work in this space, but I think there is a question about just, like, are we getting a comprehensive view of what's happening in these marketplaces?
It's the tip of the iceberg.
And I do think that, like, I mean, it cuts both ways, right? If you were a big booster, you're listening to me, you know, make these arguments to say, this guy's an idiot, right? I would say to you, like, we want that transparency so you can actually dispel some of the paranoia that has been generated by exactly the stories that journalists have been able to find. So, I think that's the first thing I'd bring up. I think the second thing to bring up is, you know, a lot of these issues are well known within the industry, right? But I guess the question is, like, do all ad buyers know about this, right? Is it widely known to the public at large, right? Like, I do think that there is kind of the circle of people who are working in this industry day in, day out. And then there are people who are pouring money into this industry, and then people who are influenced by this industry, who I think have a very murky view of how some of this works, and has been sold a particular vision of this that may not really correspond to reality.
Okay. So, and then I would also just add on that question of transparency. It's not just journalists. You do have this emerging class of sort of brand safety and viewability vendors who also anti-fraud vendors. And according to reports that these are companies that are incentivized to say there is a problem. But even according to many of their own reports, they're acknowledging incidents of fraud are going down.
Sure.
So fraud, fraud is a shrinking problem, not a growing problem.
Right, right. I mean, they also have incentives to tell you that the problem is being solved over time as well.
By them. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. But I mean, again, and I do think that, you know, Augustine Fu, who might be known to some of your listeners, right, I think has done some really interesting work trying to say, okay, we are capturing some of the fraud, but ultimately this is a bet over whether or not you think, you know, criminal actors that are making money on this are going to be faster or slower than the ad fraud industry. And I guess maybe I'm a pessimist, right? Implicitly in that I do think that, like, you know, the criminals, while this is a cat and mouse game, I do feel like the mouse has been more able to evade over time than the cats have been able to, you know, speed up their activity at catching, you know, bad actors.
Okay, great. I want to talk about one of the kind of best pieces of evidence that advertising, ad targeting, as we know, it doesn't work, which is something you cite in your book. And I've heard others cite it too, which was a 2017 study by Procter & Gamble, where they were very upset with some of the transparency issues that you describe. And they removed something like $200 million worth of digital advertising from existence. And they observed what happened to sales over time, and they said publicly, I believe, that there was not an impact on sales. So interesting for sure, because P&G is one of the biggest programmatic ad buyers in the world. But I think also they still, even after removing that $200 million from circulation, they're still one of the biggest programmatic ad buyers out there. And so doesn't that validate that they must have assessed that ad targeting works in some fashion? I'm obviously riffing on what you said earlier about, and $80 billion plus in ad spending can't be wrong. That's in the United States alone. Okay, I acknowledge that a lot of that money could be wrong, but it feels like P&G has decided at least there's still value for them.
Yeah, and so I think, again, like there's two subtleties here, right? Like one of them is that, you know, it's important not to necessarily paint with too broad of a brush in the space, right? Like it's important to remember, for example, for the subprime mortgage crisis, not every mortgage issued in the United States had to be a toxic mortgage for the market to be damaged, right? And I think one way of thinking about what Procter & Gamble is doing here is maybe exactly that, right? Like part of it is thinking about, okay, what are the forms of digital advertising where we think we are getting a return, which ones do we think are a scam, right? I think that like that's one way of kind of thinking about why they are, you know, not necessarily reducing their budget all the way down to $0 and 0 cents. I think that's one way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Another one, which I do think is really interesting, and you know, I think we're going to get into this a little bit later, is, you know, so I really like the work of Garrett Johnson over at BU. And he's done this work that kind of makes the argument you know, we have evidence that in some cases advertising does genuinely work. But the problem is that the effect is so small that we have to conduct these enormous experiments to figure out, and expensive experiments to try to figure out whether or not they actually do work, right? And, you know, I guess one way of thinking about it is, you know, maybe P&G kind of belongs to a relatively small class of actors that can run these types of, you know, experiments to try to figure this out, right? And so I do think that actually is maybe another way at the problem, which is to think about like the kind of differential impact, like who can afford to know what kinds of ads work and ads don't. And I do think that is one element of the system as well. So,
okay, wonderful. We're going to continue. First, we're going to hear a brief message from a sponsor. I'll be right back with Tim Huang. I'm talking with Yvonne Markman, Chief Business Officer with Verizon Media. Yvonne, welcome back.
Thank you, Zach.
So give us an update on Verizon Media. What is your overarching strategy and focus?
Thank you. Verizon Media is a technology and media company focused on content, experiences, commerce, and advertising. The diverse connecting nature of our business is key to our growth. We build meaningful connections that bring audiences and partners closer to their passion, including our experiences across recognized brands like Yahoo, TechCrunch, and Engadget that connect more than 900 million people monthly. And we've integrated commerce across all of these, enabling consumers to shop on Yahoo Live, place bets on Yahoo Sports, and even buy groceries through Yahoo Mail. For advertisers and publishers, we're the only omnichannel ad platform outside of walled gardens with a unified stack that cuts across a host of different ad formats and channels. And our DSP, SSP, native marketplace, and exchange are integrated so that they can all work better together to enable this ecosystem. Beyond that, we've been enabling and innovating significantly in AR, VR, machine learning, and 5G to really help our customers future-proof their business and their growth.
All right, great. So the fast approaching cookie-less future is on the minds of marketers everywhere, of course. What is Verizon Media's position and how are you helping clients prepare?
Yeah, at the highest level, I think that the most important aspect is that we need to be people first. So the need for direct consumer relationships is paramount. Last year, we announced the introduction of Connect ID, which is our identity solution for the cookie-less world. It's based on those direct consumer relationships and leveraging our identity graph that has 200 billion data signals daily that are incredibly diverse, and really using that to connect in a privacy-centric way, consumer-first way, with publishers and advertisers that are like-minded and like-enabled, who also have those relationships. And then we can run this through our connected DSP and SSP with common privacy policies and zero data leakage. So that's how we're approaching it. And we're very excited about the traction it's had so far.
Okay, and 2020 was such a huge year for content consumption. How did you see it evolve and where does it go from here in 2021?
The appetite for trusted content was greater than ever in 2020, and we'll only see that continue in 2021. What I'll say is it's not enough to just be trusted. Content needs to become more personalized, meaningful, and tailored to consumers' needs. So the evolution that we're seeing into this year is a lot more personalization on a real-time basis. And then as we think about how that connects with advertisers, it's really about how you deliver the relevant messages at the right time in the right channel, in particular in areas such as mobile, connected TV, and digital out of home. So this pertains to the channels, it pertains to dynamic creative and being able to do all of this in a simple and flexible way. And as I look at consumer behavior going forward, companies will need to continue to innovate that and serve advertisers, publishers, and consumers in better ways, more meaningful ways, more flexible ways. So what we've done is really create a unique and fully connected ecosystem that will connect consumers with their passions. And as a result of that, help advertisers and publishers engage with them with greater value.
All right. Yvonne Markman, Chief Business Officer with Verizon Media. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Zach.
And I'm back with Tim. So I think, there is a lot that we could discuss in terms of your argument.
Certainly, a lot to talk about.
Me poking at them and you responding. I do want to make sure we leave room for some other themes here that are also in your book.
Sure.
So we may come back to this question of, hey, does programmatic work? But let's assume for a moment that the vulnerabilities that you describe in the kind of programmatic edifice are valid. And we see a loss of advertiser confidence in the effectiveness of their spending in this environment. So all of a sudden, like a lot of the financial underpinnings of the free internet vanish. And you have some great lines on this. One of them is, I get the sense reading your book that that's kind of what you're hoping will happen, Tim. And I'm not saying you want the free internet or subsidized internet to go away, but clearly you've got some skin in the game and you're coming into this, you're writing this book, you know, and you're making an argument. You one of the things you say in this section on what would it mean for the internet, right, is that advertising has long had a corrosive effect on the design of the internet, and that rather than trying to fix a broken market, we should work toward a controlled demolition of programmatic infrastructure, right? So so why is a controlled demolition desirable rather than just let's expose the weaknesses and watch the whole thing fall?
Sure, exactly. So I have a couple of friends who I describe as committed ad anarchists, right? Ad nihilists, right? Who would basically say to you, look, there's nothing good about this ecosystem. It has caused all these problems. If it's got these structural problems, we should just let it blow up. Or in the very least, we should accelerate it. We should push it over a cliff, right? And I guess I kind of stake out a position which is a little bit more in the middle because I am genuinely conflicted, right? Like I do think that it's impossible to argue with the position that because online advertising subsidizes all these services, the internet is a lot more accessible, right, than it would otherwise be, right? Because people don't necessarily need to pay subscription. And so the metaphor that I've been using, this isn't in the book, but I think is a good way of thinking about it, is we are really genuinely in kind of this sort of Indiana Jones Temple of Doom type situation, right? Where we've got this idol that's sitting on the pedestal and we need to switch something else in that generates money at the same rate and same, you know, velocity and magnitude without any of the effects that we don't like in advertising, right? And I guess the question that I'm sort of faced with is that possible? How do we actually go about doing that? And I think that, you know, people often think about, you know, when they say blow up the ad economy, they're thinking about like, I don't really care if Mark Zuckerberg has a few less billion dollars, but I think they do often forget about like all of the creators online, right, that are like supported by this ecosystem. And so sure. I guess when I say controlled demolition, I guess what I'm trying to point to is the idea of like, okay, we need to move beyond this, or in the very least, we need to create a kind of economy on the internet that's less of a monoculture. But we can't just blow it up right away because so much has been built on top of it and depends on it, right? And so I guess the idea of a controlled demolition is how do we slowly spin down this economy in a way that allows alternatives to form? And, you know, again, this is like very classic kind of economic theory in some ways, right? Which is if you've inflated a market bubble, you don't want to pop it, right? The idea is how do you let air out of it slowly? And that's a little bit of kind of the direction that I'm headed in.
I see. Okay, got you. And just to be clear, the reasons that you you make a case that just advertising has even though it's provided a free internet, it has harmed our discourse, and you use this phrase that Facebook is a mind control ray, which I love. that basically like glues people to the feed. It's just messed. It's just hacked the human brain, and you know it's done this by using algorithms to create filter bubbles, which repeat people's views back to them, amplifying misinformation. So this is all in the name of selling ads. And so that's the harm you're talking about reason that you're looking to, that you think it's worth from a public mental health standpoint, moving to a different kind of internet.
Well, no. So I'd put a little bit of nuance on that, actually. So when I mentioned Facebook's mind control ray, it's actually to make fun of people who argue that position in a lot of ways, right? Again, like it's very difficult to believe that, paid media is ineffective and then simultaneously turn around and say, oh, but the organic content through the feed is effective, right? I actually think that there's good evidence to suggest that that's all in doubt, right? And again, this is kind of why the book has had kind of an interesting, you know, reception, because it has both pissed off people who are in the industry, who are big boosters of this technology and are dyed-in-the-wool believers that programmatic ads work, but it has also pissed off like tech critics, right, who have basically said the reason we need to regulate all of these platforms is because they have this mind control ray, right? But I actually say that both of them are wrong, right? I say both of them like have a completely overblown view of how effective this whole system is. So the kind of corrosive effects that I'm really interested in are things like the kind of aftermath from Cambridge Analytica, right? Where the story of Cambridge Analytica when it happened was sketchy British firm collected all this data and used it to control the election, right? But when the UK privacy regulator took a look at it, they said, we have actually no evidence that any of this psychographic targeting ever did anything, .. But the big problem was this enormous privacy violation that they engaged in. And I think that's the case here too, right? Which is like you can actually believe in a world where programmatic advertising doesn't work, but it creates huge incentives to collect enormous amounts of data about people that has all these negative side effects, right? I just think we can decouple those two things, right? That like this privacy violation can exist very separate from the effectiveness of the ads that come out the other side.
So you're doubling down.
So I don't know if that's helpful, but that's kind of how I size it up.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it is independent of whether or not it works. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Got it. I guess I'd be curious to hear you answer. Is your argument connecting? Because you wrote the book middle of last year, you've presented it, you know, to the world. Do you see signs of advertisers backing away from programmatic or being sort of listening to the arguments, or are marketers laughing at you, or... You know,
I'm sure they are.
How goes that without saying?
So.
Yes, I guarantee you, yeah. Many are. Whether they're delusional or not, the many are laughing as they're listening to this. But
sure, of course, and I think I think reasonable minds can differ. I would say there's kind of so I'm not. I'm not so self-important to suggest that this book is going to change the industry, right? That's just not going to be the case. But I would say it has resonated interestingly among two big audiences, right? One of them is regulators, right? Who I think for a long time, to go to our earlier conversation, have really been sold on this we should fear Facebook because it can control our minds, right? But increasingly what we're hearing actually from a lot of folks that I've talked to, but also places like the FTC is give us information about all the faulty data you have, right? And how do you deal with, the fraud that happens in these markets? And I think that's a really interesting thing that's happening. And I think the book is finding a good reception among those people, right? Folks in DC trying to figure out what do we do with this market that's been created? So I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's interesting. One issue with regulating programmatic is regulators don't seem too excited about regulating B2B markets. They focus more on consumer markets because they feel more harm is done there, maybe. But B2B can be boring, although obviously, we're speaking very animatedly about it and we don't find it boring at all, but.
Right, so I'm excited by it. I'm a total nerd for this stuff, so.
Do you think the FTC or Congress people have an appetite to regulate B2B?
I mean, I think the reason the market has avoided regulation for so long, despite becoming so critical to how the internet is designed, is largely because it has been so wonky, right? It's a little bit tax policy or something like that. It kind of hides in the shadows because it's not a political red meat issue in some ways until you get to the point of what's your bill to the IRS is going to be. And so I do think that increasingly though, I think that it is becoming a more kind of exciting topic for Washington, just because I think there's these broader currents at work about what do we do with all these big tech giants that have emerged over the last 20, 30 years, right? And I think that everybody wants to do quote unquote something about the big tech companies, but I think everybody's very wary about the idea of let's just break Google up, let's just break Amazon up. And so I think getting to the level of the ad markets ends up feeling like maybe this interesting kind of compromise or middle ground where it's clearly an important way for the government to shape how these companies operate, but isn't not so severe as what you might imagine for traditional antitrust. And so
it's much easier. It's much easier for them to build a case because the marketers are actually paying these tech platforms, whereas a lot of the consumers get the services for free. And most historic antitrust cases get built on price increases or price gouging or freezing. So that's not happening at the consumer level. I mean, it may eventually happen with Amazon, but for now, Amazon is lowest on price. I think you're right that, I think the B2B markets offer a lever or a way in for regulators who feel the tech companies have too much power. And you can see evidence of antitrust among some of the platform's behavior with advertisers and with other ad tech companies in this space. So unfair competition is in programmatic actually may turn out to have legs legally.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
So last year...
I actually mentioned the second audience, actually, if you don't want to lose that second audience.
Yeah, please go.
I think probably we're talking very animatedly, as you said. There's so many interesting things to chase down here. The second audience I will mention actually is advertisers. I do think that there is a kind of code of silence. And I do, since the publication of the book, I have heard from people being I've worked in paid for years. The whole thing is a scam, right? And so I don't know if that represents a majority of people, a large minority of people, or a tiny minority of people, but I do think that there are, I would say listeners to this podcast, there are people among your number who are not necessarily aligned with you that, what I'm saying is 100% bunk, right?
All right, interesting point, yeah. So I want to discuss what happened over the last year, COVID, and then just a dramatic acceleration of advertising budgets and programmatic at a time when you're predicting the downfall of programmatic. And you address this in your book because your book came out after the pandemic. So, you know, you're saying, you know, there may be a short-term sort of hurry up, more budgets moving in, but, you know, eventually a bubble, a big bubble can get even bigger, as we're also seeing in the financial markets arguably right now. But I'm curious when you believe advertiser confidence in programmatic might expire.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, the $80 billion question, right? So I think this is actually an interesting case of like the irresistible force meeting the immovable object, in the sense that the irresistible force here is, like you're pointing out, right? Like the fact that everybody being at home has created intense pressure to pour money into the programmatic ad ecosystem. The immovable object, I think, is the fact that we're about to be running this grand global behavioral experiment in privacy laws, right? And privacy products, right? So it's not just the regulation thing. It's also, you know, Google, Apple, all these companies taking steps on limiting the access to advertising data. And I do think that this is in some ways the big wager, right? Which is, okay, everybody expects that when we lose access to certain kinds of data, that certain parts of the market are just going to completely fold and collapse, right? And I guess I'm kind of an odd optimist in some ways, which is I say, well, according to my research and the thesis of the book and the researchers I've talked to, you know, advertisers may lose access to this data that they think they so critically need, only to find that ads are still pretty much as good as they always used to be. And I do think that that is actually potentially a place where there's going to be a loss of confidence, right? Because again, and this goes back to a little bit of what we were talking about earlier, it's not necessarily we're making the argument that programmatic ads are uniquely bad, right? It may just be that they're just as bad as all the other previous forms of advertising that have been out there. And I think that resetting is something that we're going to see. But to answer your question directly, right, like what is the moment, right? I think in some ways the moment's going to be, let's see what happens when as all these kind of privacy moves come into play and see what happens to the market, right? Because if the data is really so critical, then we're about to find out pretty soon that it is in fact critical when you no longer have access to it.
I do want to have a moment on research, because I think one of the, in your proposal for a controlled demolition, a managed implosion of programmatic, you suggest one way that this might come about is if an independent funded research entity conducts a lot of studies on the effectiveness of programmatic advertising. And this organization would have to not represent any special interests. It wouldn't be an industry association, but it would be more academic in nature, doing economic studies on advertising effectiveness. It's amazing to me there isn't more independent research on advertising effectiveness that's contemporary. And I'm curious, how important do you view this in the grand scheme of sort of proving out programmatic or not?
Yeah. I mean, this goes to a little bit of what we were talking about earlier, right? Which is, I do think that reasonable minds can differ on a lot of these issues. And it's in part because the cost of running truly careful causal experiments in this space is big, right? And actually really takes a lot of care and effort that we just generally haven't seen, right? And so we have these very compelling anecdotes, a couple of really interesting studies, but not a whole lot more, right? And I do think that, you know, the reason that it hasn't happened is twofold. One of them is like the topic is a little bit wonky. And the second one is that it's pretty expensive to do correctly. But I do genuinely believe, and maybe I'm an optimist in this respect, that doing these types of studies is really important because it gives us some empirical basis on which to move this conversation forwards, right? All I can do is I can see what the market has provided and the current ecosystem has provided. And I do think the ability to kind of run experiments that, you know, are sort of unbiased and neutral, you know, would do a good, I would say would do a lot of good, right? Both for regulators in the space, for the industry in the space, and also kind of what the public understands about this economy. And so I guess I'm still kind of a believer in the ability for research to kind of shape the policy discussion and the business discussion here.
Great. Meanwhile, we have a lot of research being done privately, and it's, you know, the
we do
the, you know, the largest brands in the world are doing big time studies, incrementality studies, lots of experiments, and feeding that data into their media mix models and as well as into their programmatic investments. But they're just not sharing, which is infuriating to me. They, because it, mm-hmm. It speaks to a sort of a lack of collective self-interest. It's only individual self-interest on the parts of the marketers working in-house at these brands.
Sure. Yeah.
So I would love to see. I mean, there's the Advertising Research Foundation is an association that is theoretically sort of offering kind of best practices at least and some knowledge sharing around these kinds of research projects, but it just seems to me like there isn't enough. So I'll put it out there to our listeners: if you are a marketer with a big brand that's doing a lot of studies and on these things that Tim and I are talking about today, feel free to reach out, and maybe there's a way to expose some of your findings without it giving away your special sauce. Everybody's so afraid their competitors are going to get access to their data.
Well, yeah, and I think that's ultimately, yeah. And there's a part of me that kind of ultimately finds those types of explanations for why we're not revealing this stuff kind of shallow ultimately, right? Like, I think that if there's nothing to hide, then they should be willing to show it, right? And particularly if it really kind of conclusively resolves some of the debates that we're having. Yeah, I don't know. I guess, Zach, I would echo that call, right? If anyone's out there who's interested in this stuff, yeah, would be excited to hear about it.
Great. So, Tim, what is next for you? What are you working on now?
Sure. The primary project now is to really kind of take that controlled demolition to the next level, if you will. maybe that won't come as a kind of happy bit of news for, again, your listeners. But I am really interested in thinking about, okay, so what is the regulatory structure around this kind of stuff look like, and how does it sort of play out in sort of the evolving DC discussion about platform regulation, tech regulation, and so a lot of my work right now is kind of converting some of the work in the book into policy briefs, proposed regulation, that sort of thing, and so that's where I'm spending a lot of my time nowadays.
Interesting. Can you share anything about who your clients are or who you're presenting these briefs
to? unfortunately, no. But it will be becoming public pretty soon, and I'll be sure to keep you in the loop.
All right, Tim Huang, fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of AdExchanger Talks. We'll see you next time. This episode was brought to you by Verizon Media, connecting people to their passions. With quality connections scaled for growth, Verizon Media is helping advertisers and publishers reach their goals and future-proof their businesses. Tune in next week to hear more from Verizon Media. Visit verizon.media/VMAUDIO21 to learn more.